Welcome to VOA Asia Weekend. For the next hour, we will divert from our normal presentation of the past week in review. You'll hear the full-length versions of many of the interviews and features that we have presented through the past few months on our daily VOA Asia program. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. We begin with a story that is 30 years old. That is when student-led pro-democracy protests centered on Beijing's Tiananmen Square, with corruption among the elite a key complaint among demonstrators. Protesters were also calling for political reforms and a fairer and more open society. Human rights groups believe several hundred to several thousand people were killed when tanks rolled through Tiananmen Square to squelch the demonstrations. State Department spokesman Morgan Ortegas told VOA during a press briefing the United States continues to mark and condemn the 1989 incident.
We shouldn't forget that this was a full-on massacre of peaceful protesters that occurred. We remember the tragic loss of innocent lives, and as we do every year, and we will again this year, express our deep sorrow to the families who are still grieving.
Ortegas added, "We want those released who have been jailed for striving to keep the memory of Tiananmen Square alive and an end to the continued harassment of demonstration participants and their families."
The U.S. Has called for, and we will continue to call for, as have others in the international community, a full public accounting for those killed, detained, and missing.
According to Amnesty International, police in China have detained, placed under house arrest, or threatened dozens of activists who were seeking to mark the anniversary, as well as relatives of those killed. Jeffrey Wasserstrom is professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. Wasserstrom's research interests began with the role of student protest and have grown to include the social history of China and comparative social history. He explained to my colleague Jim Stevenson the buildup to the June 4th crackdown.
I think one thing that's significant looking back is that the fact that there was a crackdown wasn't really what seemed so surprising at the time. What seemed surprising was how long it took for the government to take decisive actions. And I think that division at the top is a key part of things. One is that in a lot of ways the protests were simply calling on the Communist Party to live up to its own professed ideals. And there could be some resonance of that among Communist Party officials at the time. There was probably a hope on the part of the leadership that this would just fizzle out, that this would dissipate. And then there was also a hope, I think, when they brought out this harsh editorial April 26th condemning the protesters and saying that the protesters were creating turmoil, a kind of code word for the kind of chaos that was associated with the Cultural Revolution period that nobody really wanted to go back to, that the protesters would just leave. But in fact, that editorial just angered a lot of people who saw what was going on in the streets not as turmoil and chaos, but as simple demands for change that were acceptable. And so a series of moves that the government made that they thought would tamp down the protests actually served to rev them up. So there were a variety of factors going on there.
The government in Beijing moved very quickly to distance itself from the events of June 4th. In fact, pretty much tried to erase that from the public memory. And one of the amazing outcomes of the events then is that they were highly successful in doing so. Why is the government still so fearful of what happened that day?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I do think the whole phenomenon of this effort to put a state of amnesia on the events. I mean, I do think that what the Communist Party keeps saying is, look how far we've come. Look how far we've come. Look at how strong China is in the world. Look at the booming economy. Look at the spectacle of the Olympics. And I think it goes along with the forced amnesia, because it's an effort to keep people distracted and focusing on different things, so that even if they get an inkling of the messiness that the government was involved with, that maybe this will discourage them from pushing too hard, trying too hard to find out more. And anything that the Western press has gotten wrong then or since is exploited to say, well, they got that wrong, so maybe they're lying about everything. So even though there's enormous proof of a vicious crackdown, these different factors working together have been disturbingly successful within the mainland, because there is so much control over the media communication.
Jeffrey Wasterstrom, professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. To provide some perspective about what happened at Tiananmen Square in 1989, Jim Stevenson spoke with one of the top four student leaders of that movement, Shen Tang.
I was a student back in 1989, a third-year student at Beijing University, when I was involved in the student movement since 86. But when the spring of 1989 started, I was first elected as the student autonomous union in Beida, Peking University, and then later on become an early organizer of what's known as a dialogue delegation, one of the three main umbrella student organizations. Our main responsibility was to negotiate with the government on behalf of the demonstrators.
A lot of us focus on the anniversary of June 4th. This actually began quite some time before that. What was the genesis of the student movement?
It was a build-up since, more specifically, the mid-80s, but more broadly defined, ever since the start of the open door and reform policy in the end of 1970s, a couple of years after Mao's death. But more specifically, since 1985, 86, there's waves of national student movement, generally calling for broader reform and end of official corruption. But specifically, on April 15th, 1989, the sudden death of the former communist chief Hu Yaobang was a surprise to the students. Students generally felt he was ousted because of the student movement back in 1986. So his death sparked a wave of commemoration that was curiously suppressed by the hardliners at the time, so that suppression was actually further triggered a broader dissent and protest.
How did the movement gather such growth so that it came to Tiananmen Square?
Well, it's a moment. It was more a moment than a movement. It's very similar to, say, Occupy Wall Street last fall, where you really tap into a national psyche it's known as a movement or a moment of rising expectations. Things were generally getting better in some significant ways to people's daily life in China, but the perceived and the sudden inequality and very visible official corruptions made people edgy, if not very dissatisfied. So the student protest quickly turned into a broader call of government accountability and of official corruption that really tapped into that national psyche at the time.
Did you get a sense that there was something coming?
It's one of those things that the day before you think it's impossible, the day after it becomes inevitable. So in some larger sense, I would say nobody predicted that. But then as the event took off, as the moment actually was upon us, all these factors before that seems leading to that inevitability.
Did China miss an opportunity because of this?
Absolutely. I think it's not just China, because it's both symbolic and a real influence in the world affairs. It actually, the world missed a major opportunity. The world history would have been different if the events of the spring of 1989 turned out differently. And there's every possibility that it could have had a different result, that the massacre wasn't inevitable. China could have gone onto a more balanced development instead of embracing this unbalanced full embrace of materialism, which now eventually led to the breakdown of moral, if not social, fabrics in China.
Shen Tang, a top student leader in the democracy movement at Tiananmen Square 30 years ago. Also in 1989, Shen Tang was named one of the People of the Year by Newsweek magazine. He is now a media and software entrepreneur. 30 years after the bloody crackdown by the Chinese government on the student-led pro-democracy movement, student leaders and activists of the movement attended a recent conference in Washington, D.C., a suburb of the city, where they talked about what happened in Beijing's Tiananmen Square and why. VOA's Xiao Yu and Hai Lun filed this report, narrated by Anna Cook.
On the night of June 3, 1989, crowds gathered on Tiananmen Square in the center of Beijing. Among them was Yan Jiaqi, then director of the Political Research Institute of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences.
Later, I realized at that moment shots had already been fired, but the hundreds of thousands of people at Tiananmen Square didn't see what was coming at them.
Armed troops and military vehicles advanced toward the protesters on Tiananmen Square from different directions outside the city. Those in the square had no idea what was approaching them. And around midnight, Yan returned home.
As I fell asleep around 1 or 2 a.m., I suddenly heard loud gunshots that sounded just like firecrackers. But the sound was much louder and sharper. We ran toward the balcony to take a look. Our balcony was on the east side of the alley where you could see East Chang'an Street. We saw a lot of flashes and tense ones. At that time, I knew they had opened fire, and I thought China had really changed.
That evening, along dimly lit streets, journalist Wang Juntao watched soldiers fire relentlessly on the crowd.
People attacked a few vehicles with bricks, marching forward, screaming, one, two, three. They stood together. Those bricks struck like raindrops. And as the bricks were thrown, the soldiers continued to fire.
Wang, who spoke recently at a forum in a Washington suburb along with other Tiananmen survivors, said some memories are still vivid. 30 years later,
I saw for the first time a human die with eyes still wide open. His face was looking up at the sky, and his head was streaming down with blood. My head felt numb. It occurred to me that day was going to remain as a solemn day in China's history. China's politics was taking a huge step backwards.
On the night of June 3rd, when Peking University student Wang Dan heard that troops had opened fire, his initial reaction was disbelief.
Students called each other to spread the news that the government troops had opened fire at protesters. When the calls first came in, I still didn't believe what was said. But later, as calls increased, I realized it must be true. For 2 or 3 days, I had absolutely no thoughts because, you know, your brain turns numb with big shocks.
Yan Jiaqi says the government's inability to own up to what happened that night continues to hold the country back.
What happened on June 4th, 1989 needs to be corrected to all of China as a massacre, an act of crime on the people executed by the Communist Party. China as a country will never move forward if the truth about June 4th, 1989 is not told. Without justice, China will have no future.
Talk of Tiananmen remains heavily censored in China, where the bloody crackdown is still referred to by the government as a counter-revolutionary riot. For Xiaoyu and Hailun, this is Anna Cook, VOA News, Washington.
Perhaps the most iconic image from 30 years ago at Tiananmen Square was that of a Chinese man standing in the middle of the street, halting the progression of several army tanks. The identity of the man and his eventual fate remain unknown to this day. We do know who took the photograph, American Jeff Widener, who was working for the Associated Press. He shared with Jim Stevenson his story of taking that photo and about the many obstacles that could have prevented the world from ever seeing it.
My job was to go to Tiananmen Square every morning and photograph the activities. And it was, a very jovial experience, almost like a carnival atmosphere. Everybody was celebrating this new freedom that they had. On the night of June 4th, I went out, and things started really getting pretty heavy. There was a burning armored car, and I lifted the camera to my eye. At the second, a large brick hit me in the face. The camera absorbed the blow. Fortunately, it saved my life. And then I had to get back to the AP office and file. I didn't go back out. I was just too scared. I was sick. I had a massive concussion. So I drew the small straw again, and it was my job to go to the Beijing Hotel, which had the closest vantage point. And I got there, and I had to get past secret police who were using electric cattle prods on the journalist. Fortunately, one young college kid from America named Kirk Martson, he managed to smuggle me up into his room, and that's where I made the tank man photograph.
This must have been an absolutely astounding scene that was playing out before your eyes as you're watching this lone gentleman walk out into the street in front of a line of tanks.
It was and it wasn't, because you have to remember I had a massive concussion. I was really spaced out, and nothing was really making a lot of sense to me. So seeing a guy walking out in the middle of a boulevard with shopping bags and confronting tanks just seemed par for the course. when I saw the tanks coming down the street, I lined up my 400-millimeter lens, and I thought, well, you know, it's a nice shot. And the guy walks out, and the first thing I said, well, this guy's going to screw up my composition. And then Kirk's screaming, they're going to kill him, they're going to kill him. And so, you know, I looked at this guy just waiting for the instant he was going to be, you know, shot. But nothing happened, you know, and he's just still there, standing there. And so I realized the picture was too far away, and I looked back at the bed where I had a lens doubler. This would increase my focal length to 800 millimeter. So the situation was, do I gamble and maybe miss the shot completely, or do I go and try to increase the magnification to get a better picture? Well, I did that, and I took three frames, and I realized something was wrong with my camera setting. The shutter speed was too slow. And by that time, Tank Man was taken away. It was an error I made on the sensitivity of the film, but fortunately one picture came out.
How were you able to get your film out of there with so much security in the hotel?
Well, thank God for Kirk Martin, because he was instrumental in not only getting me to the roof, but he also helped me with getting the film past the secret police. You know, he just looked like a, you know, sort of a college student. He had short pants on, sandals, a dirty Rambo T-shirt. You know, he just looked like, you know, a young kid. And so he smuggled all my film into his shorts. He goes all the way down to the looking for the AP office, can't find it, is smart enough to think about going to the American Embassy, tells him it's very important film and it needs to go to AP. Fortunately, the American Embassy did that. They transferred the film over to the office, and it was transmitted to the rest of the world, and that's how it was done. Mm. And he really risked his life doing that. The other thing that's interesting about that is that because we were so busy, the chemicals were not refreshed properly. So the Tank Man negative actually started disintegrating almost immediately. And fortunately, AP managed to preserve it long enough digitally before it completely disintegrated. And right now, it basically the negative is just gone completely.
Another interesting caveat to the story, Jeff Widener had run out of film and was fortunate enough to secure a role from a tourist. That was the film used for the Tank Man photo. In the 30 years since the Tiananmen Square incident, China's government has systematically suppressed any discussion or mention of the event. News reports on that day were instantly beamed around the world. Because of the clampdown of information inside China, stories from people directly involved remain quiet secrets. Journalist Louisa Lim spent 10 years in China reporting for the BBC and for the U.S.-based National Public Radio. Lim took extraordinary precautions to tell some of these stories in her book, The People's Republic of Amnesia.
People who were involved in the events, they're growing old, and their stories are not being told. I thought about it for so long, and I thought, well, if I don't write this book, who will write this book? So I really hope that this book will really, in some ways, reopen the discussion about how history is treated and how people in China have gone along with the government and how this whole sense of national identity that has been created is actually riding on the back of, in many ways, history which is false.
Tell me a little bit about some of these interviews that you conducted and some of the logistics involved in speaking with these people. It's a very sensitive topic.
It is a very sensitive topic. And several of the people who I interviewed were under various forms of surveillance because of their past. There was one woman called Zhang Xianling, 76 years old. She is the co-founder of a group called the Tiananmen Mothers. Her 19-year-old son died in 1989. He died from one bullet to the head when he tried to take a picture of the martial law troops. The first time I went to visit her, when she opened the door to me, the very first words that she said were, "I had a telephone call from the police this morning and they knew you were coming." I think she summed it up best when she said to me, something along the lines of, "Isn't it amazing that the state can be so worried about a little old lady like me?" It shows how powerful we are, these group of old people, because we represent righteousness, and the state knows that, and that's why they're scared of us.
Did you get any sense through your interviews that at some point in time, the government may open up a little bit about this issue, or are they just content to let it disappear into the fog of history?
There was hope before Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang took power that this might happen. But in fact, very early on, Xi Jinping signaled that, you know, not only was 1989 not up for discussion, but actually anything that happened even during the reign of Chairman Mao, none of that was up for discussion. When I started doing this book, and I just wanted to find out how much young people knew about 1989, I went to some of Beijing's top universities and I took the picture of Tank Man, the man standing in front of the line of tanks, and I asked 100 students if they could tell me when and where this picture was taken, and I was really surprised that only 15 out of 100 could place the picture as being taken in China. And that really made me think that the Chinese government's been very successful at, you know, deleting this memory and making sure that young people, they're just not interested in politics. They don't seek out that kind of information because they know that it could be dangerous.
Louisa Lim, correspondent for the BBC and the U.S.-based National Public Radio Network, speaking about her book, The People's Republic of Amnesia. It's published by Oxford University Press. Deepening its trade war with the U.S. and sending world financial markets into a slide, China announced higher tariffs on $60 billion worth of American goods in retaliation for President Donald Trump's latest penalties on Chinese products. Tariffs of 5 to 25% were scheduled to take effect on June 1st on about 5,200 American products, including batteries, spinach, and coffee, that according to the finance ministry. The announcement followed a move by the U.S. on Friday to raise duties on $200 billion of Chinese imports to 25%, up from 10%. American officials accused China of backtracking on commitments it made in earlier negotiations. 2 days of trade negotiations between U.S. and Chinese representatives broke up without any agreement. Both countries have indicated more talks are likely, but does the current stalemate between the United States and China portend a larger, more drawn-out confrontation or confrontations between the two countries? That is what I asked Dr. David Lampton, a China expert and fellow at the Stanford Asia-Pacific Research Center in Palo Alto, California.
Yes, and I think we're in, our two nations are in an increasingly comprehensive confrontation, not limited just to trade, although that's the news of the moment, but it includes a mounting arms race, it includes diplomatic competition around the world, with China operating in Latin America and Venezuela and so forth, Middle East, in places where we've traditionally seen ourselves as dominant. And then there, of course, we're operating on China's periphery, wooing Vietnam, trying to keep the Philippines in the U.S. column, so to speak. And so we see each country competing with the other for diplomatic influence. And then, of course, we've got these economic conflicts.
What is it about the current stances of both countries that put them at loggerheads?
Well, I think, in a way, we have to be a little philosophical and see that the last three, four decades of globalization have led to massive populations rising economically and had lots of positive benefits, but also all over the world, it has increased economic inequality, and those people, broadly speaking, who have not benefited from globalization as much as they think they should have, or would have been more equitable had they benefited, they now are finding political voice, and we see the rise of populist leaders really all over the world, and Mr. Trump and Mr. Xi, which I would say for these purposes is a somewhat populist leader, but we see this phenomenon in Duterte in the Philippines. We see it in Erdogan in Turkey. We are having the rise of leaders that are trying to galvanize domestic political support by feeding their dissatisfactions with inequality and volatility in world markets and the difficulty of poorly educated people to get middle-class paying jobs and so forth. So I think this is a global phenomenon, and China and the United States are just the two biggest examples.
So you see pretty much the same reason, rather than really stark differences between these two sides, China and the United States.
The long and the short of it is that China has increased its capabilities, I think, much more rapidly than many anticipated. And it's predictable, I think, how China's using this new power. But nonetheless, it's a surprise. So what we have is a kind of volatile mixture of unanticipated strength on the one hand and resentment in much of our society by the people who have been left behind and the unfair practices that they think, and I think correctly in many cases they're accurate, that China has used to get ahead. And so we're seeing all this combination of unanticipated strength and resentment merge.
What do you say to those who say China has been ripping the United States off?
First of all, there's a lot of truth in that, so we can't dismiss that, and we would look at intellectual property, forced technology transfer, not allowing our most competitive firms access in China, stealing intellectual property, cyber violations, and so on. So there is a real there, and the U.S. has had enough, and I think it's justifiably had enough. So China's going to have to respond to all of that. But I think we don't, and if they don't, we're going to have very big problems. But I think there's another side of the story, too, and that is that the U.S. has not been doing the basic things it needs to do to be competitive. And so at the same time we blame and try to get China to mend its ways, we have to increase our, I think, comprehensive national capabilities. I mean, our healthcare is far from anywhere near the top of the industrial world in terms of outcomes, not to mention the cost of it. Our educational systems, state university systems, are reducing their input all the time into public education at an affordable cost at the college level. Our infrastructure we've allowed to deteriorate, as everybody who drives to work can see clearly. And so at the same time, I don't think we should be in a frame of mind of blaming China for all our ills. Because frankly, if China behaved better in terms of its economic behavior, we'd still have enormous problems. So I think we have to, kind of have a balanced outlook. At the same time we push China hard on these issues, we shouldn't engage in destructive to ourselves activity, and we ought to focus on the things we can change, whether we have any cooperation from China or not.
When I was in college so many decades ago and taking sociology classes, the term ethnocentrism kept cropping up. For those who don't know ethnocentrism, that's the evaluation of other cultures using the standards and customs of your own.
I think that both countries are have a sort of exceptionalism. They're both ethnocentric. And frankly, if you look at the political theme that Xi Jinping is using in China to the great revitalization of Chinese civilization and packaging what he's doing in trade and military development and so on, you're hard-pressed to say how is this different than Make America Great Again.
U.S. President Trump started raising tariffs last July over complaints that China steals or pressures companies to hand over technology. Washington also wants Beijing to roll back government support for Chinese companies striving to become global leaders in robotics and other technology. We move on now to North Korea, where the country test-fired several missiles early in May. Following those test launches by North Korea, a squabble broke out between U.S. President Donald Trump and his national security adviser, John Bolton. I spoke with Vipin Narang, an associate professor of political science and a member of the Security Studies program at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, about whether or not North Korea's missile test violated UN and U.S. resolutions.
It definitely was a violation of UN Security Council resolutions. The problem was that Secretary Pompeo, a couple of weeks ago to Chris Wallace, had said very clearly that North Korea's debut of a brand new, by the way, short-range, solid-fuel short-range ballistic missile in May, was not a violation of at least the oral commitments he had made to the president or to the United States since the process began, because they were not ICBMs or what the United States has previously said, long-range missile tests. But Secretary Pompeo very specifically said that the moratorium that the United States believed that North Korea had imposed on itself was restricted very narrowly only to ICBMs. But John Bolton is not incorrect. It is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions. But Trump's tweet yesterday, there's a lot going on in that tweet. In addition to, responding to John Bolton, he also, you know, takes the opportunity to agree with Kim Jong-un in his characterization of Joe Biden as low IQ. He still says that Kim is going to live up to his promises. So there's a lot to dissect in those 280 characters, none of which I think are particularly helpful to the process.
Not helpful to the process, but what is the most important as far as you're concerned?
I think this dispute about, for a long time, Kim Jong-un has been pretending to disarm and Trump has been basically pretending to believe him. And now we're at the point where, how long can this continue? Now, it's certainly the case. So, yes, it's true that the short-range ballistic missile test violated UN Security Council resolutions, but it's also true that, according to President Trump's understanding of the missile test moratorium, it didn't. The problem is Kim Jong-un is also, I think, trying or potentially approaching, breaking point. He has domestic politics also to deal with, and the short-range ballistic missile test may just be kind of the beginning of a maximum pressure campaign of Kim Jong-un's own to try to get the United States to moderate its negotiating position. Now, the question is whether President Trump is willing to negotiate to moderate America's negotiating position, which at Hanoi was very maximalist. It basically demanded that Kim Jong-un unilaterally surrender all of his weapons of mass destruction programs and his ballistic missile programs up front before any sanctions relief. Now, that's not what Kim Jong-un was expecting. And so if President Trump says, OK, this isn't a short-range ballistic missile test, this ballistic missile test doesn't violate any of the agreements we've had in the past, but I'm still not willing to moderate the U.S. negotiating position, then Kim Jong-un may just start testing more frequently and test longer-range missiles to see how long, President Trump is willing to keep his head in the sand and unwilling to moderate his position. I think we're entering a very precarious phase, and North Korea has very clearly indicated to the United States that there's an end-of-year deadline for the United States to come back to kind of a step-by-step phasing, phase process in the negotiating, in negotiations. And we'll see. The clock is ticking, and we'll see whether, Kim Jong-un does extend or push the line on these tests and whether Trump still continues to deny that they're provocations and or violations of at least the spirit of the Singapore process.
So what happens in your mind when that point is reached where the U.S. won't take anymore?
Well, so the risk is that Kim Jong-un tests one missile too many or one too far in the next coming months and Trump just flips. And we've seen that if Trump feels betrayed, he can lash out very aggressively. And there is John Bolton standing there with the only other alternative to the Hanoi and Singapore process, which is, the American and North Korean approach at this point is kind of, call it denuclearization by diplomacy. We know that Kim Jong-un isn't going to give up his nuclear weapons program willingly and voluntarily, but there are caps and freezes that we can possibly negotiate. But if that doesn't work and Trump says, okay, Kim has just betrayed the trust and the spirit of this process, John Bolton has advocated the only other alternative, which is denuclearization by force. And that means, what Lindsey Graham has said, which is basically trying to, destroy North Korea's nuclear weapons facilities and program through military action. The problem is North Korea has nuclear weapons, and the chance that a nuclear weapon goes off in the region or against the United States when you attempt a military action to get rid of them is non-trivial. And so, that's the alternative, and the risk is very, very high that you end up in a military conflict that could result in a nuclear use.
Well, what happens then as far as China is concerned, Russia is concerned, Japan is concerned? What happens if that happens?
Yeah, I think that we're entering uncharted territory. I think that's right. The the Chinese and the Russians would be extremely concerned if the temperature rises again on the Korean Peninsula, as would, most importantly, you know, South Koreans and Japanese, who would face the brunt of the military action. I mean, we're talking as if the allies don't matter. And, you know, one of the concerns when Secretary Pompeo said, for example, that the short-range ballistic missile test isn't a problem is, well, we still have, you know, it's a problem for our allies. It's also the case that we have tens of thousands of forces in South Korea and Japan, including dependents, who would be at risk when these missiles are perfected and improved. And, you know, it does affect American security, not to mention allied security. So, you know, let's hope we don't get there. But, you know, we're entering a phase where, you know, Kim Jong-un went to Hanoi and put a lot on the line, you know, on President Trump at Hanoi also, and walked away empty-handed. And we forget that North Korea, even though it's an authoritarian regime, there's still hardliners in domestic politics that Kim Jong-un has to contend with. And we don't know how long he can continue trying to play this game and pirouette with President Trump without getting meaningful sanctions away from the United States, which is why taking their word very seriously, I think, is really important as we approach the end of the year.
Well, in the tweet, President Trump also said that he has confidence that Kim Jong-un will keep his promise to me in moving toward denuclearization. That's just a continuation and a reinforcement, one would think, of Trump's personal diplomacy, which he thinks still works.
Right. And there are two ways to interpret that. One is, you know, there's the missile testing moratorium promise. The second is, you know, the President Trump still insists and Secretary Pompeo still insists that Kim Jong-un promised to disarm the final fully verified denuclearization of North Korea. Secretary Pompeo said that Kim said this to his face half a dozen times. Here's the problem. North Korea and Kim Jong-un has never said that. There's no evidence that Kim Jong-un promised to unilaterally disarm. And the risk is that if President Trump really believes that, and this tweet is referring to the full disarmament process and not just the testing moratorium, then we really do have a problem, because if President Trump continues to believe that Kim Jong-un promised to disarm and will disarm, and is not just pretending to believe it, then we really have a problem, because Kim Jong-un never agreed to that.
Well, is there a possibility that the U.S. might someday or sometime agree with steps taken as far as bans are concerned in order for gradual improvement in North Korea's denuclearization?
Yeah, no, I've written this with, you know, some of my co-authors like Ankit Panda in Foreign Affairs recently, that, you know, Washington is allergic to coexisting or living with adversaries that acquire nuclear weapons. And I understand the reason for that. Our non-proliferation policy depends on not, quote unquote, accepting any new nuclear states. The problem is North Korea is the horse that got out of the barn. And the reality is they have nuclear weapons. And what's the price you're willing to pay to get rid of them? Now, a military strike, I think, is too high a price. So in my view, the U.S. administration, should move towards kind of a step-by-step process where you say, look, you can keep the rhetorical end state, kind of like President Obama in 2009 at Prague. Maybe sometime in future lifetimes, North Korea will give up its nuclear weapons, will have a world free of nuclear weapons. That's a great aspirational goal. But in the meantime, you have to live with the fact that North Korea actually does have nuclear weapons. And it is beneficial to American and global security to cap the size of that program. So North Korea doesn't sell its weapons or technology to other states, so it can more securely and effectively manage the weapons it has. Slowing the growth of the program is step number one. Step number two then is freezing the program where it's at. At some point, you can talk about steps beyond that, you know, rolling back part of the program, and then eventually disarmament. But those are aspirational goals, and it doesn't mean, you know, you shouldn't be, in my view, we shouldn't be swinging for the fences right off the bat. We should try to get on base. And right now, the problem with shooting for a grand deal right now is for every day that passes without a grand deal, North Korea gets stronger and gets more leverage. It continues to produce nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles and has, since the Singapore summit, probably developed, you know, six or seven or a dozen nuclear weapons, several ICBMs and other missiles. And so every day it's getting stronger. And as it gets stronger, we lose leverage. So every day that passes without a grand deal is one where we lose the ability to even slow the growth of the program.
You might remember that the U.S. Justice Department announced this year that the United States had seized a North Korean ship the previous year. We wanted to find out more, so we reached one of those who had actually boarded that ship when he was a member of a United Nations inspection team. North Korea accused the United States of robbery Tuesday and demanded the immediate return of a cargo ship seized for allegedly violating international sanctions. In a statement in the official Korean Central News Agency, North Korea's foreign ministry warned of unspecified consequences in response to the U.S. seizure of the Wise Honest. KCNA statement claimed the seizure violates the 2018 agreement between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to improve bilateral relations. The United States announced last week that it had seized the ship, which was originally detained in April of last year by Indonesian authorities. U.S. officials say the 17,000-ton vessel, North Korea's second-largest cargo ship, had been used to export North Korean coal in violation of international sanctions. That's the first time U.S. officials had seized a North Korean vessel. We welcome to VOA Asia Neil Watts. He served as the maritime expert on the U.N. panel of experts for North Korea for 5 years until last year. Neil, welcome. Are there any valid grounds on which Pyongyang can claim that their ship was robbed?
I don't think so. I think the resolutions are quite clear in terms of if you're involved in ship-to-ship transfers or activities prohibited by the resolutions, that your vessel could be subject to seizure by member states. And the resolutions provide for that and give member states a mandate to do so.
Well, under a series of sanctions by both the United States and the United Nations, North Korea is prohibited from a broad range of economic activities. When it was detained in 2018, the ship was carrying about 25,500 tons of coal, a load valued at around $3 million at the time. What happened to that cargo?
Well, I'm not entirely sure where the cargo is now. The last information I had that it was on its way to Malaysia, where Indonesian court had released the coal, according to Indonesian authorities, to be re-exported. What has subsequently happened in terms of the coal's destination in Malaysia, I'm not aware of.
Now, where would the money for that go? To the United States? Would it go to Indonesia? Where would it go?
Well, the money supposedly, once it's paid for by the company buying it in Malaysia, would pay the broker. And the question is, who's the broker going to pay in terms of the coal which came from North Korea and the ship which was captured in Nampo by satellite loading the coal? So it's quite clear where the coal comes from, and the fact that it comes from North Korea means that it is illicit coal.
How is North Korea getting around these sanctions for the most part?
It's getting around the sanctions through various means. The primary means right now is through ship-to-ship transfers. Apparently, the Wise Honest was destined to make a transfer to another ship via ship-to-ship transfer nearby Balikpapan in Indonesia. But, of course, this did not happen. So we're not sure which ship it was going to go to. But there's no doubt that Korea is managing to export its coal either through transshipment or by ship-to-ship transfers through complicit companies are quite aware that it is North Korean coal and are quite aware that it is prohibited by the resolutions.
Is there any better way to police these sanctions?
That's not an easy question to answer, but suffice to say, unlike petroleum products, coal has to be landed in a port somewhere. And so that is the point where coal should be interdicted. Of course, it can be interdicted while the vessel is outside of port or in the bay, as in the case of the Wise Honest and a number of other ships. The Wuofu was another case in point that was destined for Vietnam, but Vietnam turned the vessel away. And the vessel, in fact, loitered nearly a month outside of Vietnamese waters while they were deciding where that coal should go. So essentially, that's the key interdiction point, is wherever it's going to be disembarked at a port.
How does this happen? Are nations complicit or are just companies complicit in this? I heard that some of the ships leave North Korea, pay a visit to a port in Russia, you know, drop it off, pick up something else, and then later on pick up the coal from or oil or whatever it is from Russia and deliver it someplace else.
My personal view is that I don't think these are nations involved. I think these are the companies looking to make a quick buck, because, of course, there's always money to be made out of sanctions because of the high risk, high payment phenomena. And I believe this is simply companies exploiting the situation where you get this really good quality North Korean coal at a great price, and therefore you could make good profits, probably a million plus.
Now, as far as identification of these ships, this has been rather loose for many reasons for a long time, as far as I can remember anyway, where ships that are berthed, are docked, or have a home port of, let's say, Washington, D.C. or New York City, carry a Panamanian flag. And that happens all the time, right?
Yes, this is correct. And the phenomenon is known as the flag of convenience. Very often, the vessels that are flagged by a certain country, which is the equivalent of a passport, they invariably never even go to their home port that's painted on their stern. But it is merely a means to save money by using a certain flag, as the costs may, or the checks on the vessel may be less rigorous in terms of compliance.
Are the checks less rigorous as far as North Korean ships are concerned?
Well, I can only say that the record for inspection speaks for itself. You can log on to the Tokyo MOU database. It's an open source database, and you can see the number of deficiencies and defects found by port state control inspections. And typically, North Korean vessels would have a low safety record in this regard and a low rating.
How many such ships, like the one that was seized, are in operation right now and carrying out the same type of business?
Look, the Wise Honest is a North Korean ship. Of that, there's no doubt. What they did try to do was disguise themselves. And this is a common phenomenon. In the case of the Wise Honest, it had documents on board to say that it was a Sierra Leone ship and the crew were Sierra Leoneans, because, of course, it is also prohibited to use a North Korean crew. So to get around those two aspects, they pretended it was a Sierra Leone flag. It was flagged in Sierra Leone at one point, but between Sierra Leone, it was flagged to Tanzania. So if you look at the record of the Wise Honest, and this is common of a lot of these kind of ships, they do what's called registry hopping. And that is going from one registry to another, in effect trying to launder these vessels to disassociate themselves from North Korea. I think that the seizure of the Wise Honest sends a signal that, in particular, the U.S. is serious about the enforcement of sanctions, and particularly under the maximum pressure campaign. I've been saying for a long time that a lot of vessels that have been identified as carrying out prohibited activity have continued the activities without any recourse, except for the fact that they were named and shamed in panel of experts reports. And I think if there is a tighter control over the movement of these ships, such as impounding them or seizing them, thus far only three countries have done this. The first was, in fact, Mexico with the Muda bomb, which was seized and subsequently sold for scrap. Then the South Koreans have seized at least four vessels that I know of, and they've impounded them, in fact, under the resolutions. And these are still with South Korea. And so this ship seized by the U.S. makes them only the third country to have done so. So many countries are identifying or photographing these vessels that are breaking the sanctions. But thus far, only three have done anything about it.
The United Nations can bring up what is wrong, but it cannot do anything as far as seizing a ship is concerned.
All the UN can do is, through the panel of experts and the 17-18 committee, is to alert member states of illicit activity. And it is up to the member states, who are the eyes, ears, and teeth of the United Nations, to take the appropriate action. Now, the problem with ships is it's quite a big burden to seize or impound a ship. because now you're responsible for keeping this. It falls under the aegis of a frozen asset, meaning that you have to keep the asset in the state that you seized or impounded the vessel. So it implies that you're now responsible for to ensure that it's maintained and kept in the state that you impounded the vessel. Secondly, it's a burden in terms of where do you put the vessel. If it's at a berth or in a congested area where there's a lot of trade happening, there could be a loss in terms of opportunity costs for trade. And then thirdly, should North Korea opt not to maintain the vessel, i.e. send technicians and send spares, you're now stuck with this vessel. So what are you going to do? In the case of Mexico, they offered North Korea the opportunity to maintain the vessel, which they declined. And so to defray all the costs that had been incurred with regards to the Mudubong, they sold it for scrap. Now, one must keep in mind, this is all about the ship. One mustn't confuse the illicit cargo with the activities of the ship. In this case, the cargo and the ship coincides in terms of it is a North Korean ship, there's no doubt. And secondly, there's a coal which is definitely prohibited under the resolution since August 2017.
Is coal and oil the only commodities that are really at issue here? Are there other cargoes that are subject to and do actually happen as far as illicit trade is concerned?
No, there are other cargoes as well. In the case of the Jishan, which was interdicted by Egypt, it's in addition to the arms cargo, it had been covered with limonite, which is a type of iron ore. Now, iron ore is also prohibited under resolutions. But thus far, these are the only commodities that have been found on board ships. You'll see in the news also that the Wise Honest had delivered heavy machinery, which are also prohibited by the resolutions in December in 2017. It also delivered heavy machinery to North Korea. So It's obvious that it's a repeat offender in terms of violations of the resolutions.
There was one other thing I wanted to ask you, and that is that I read that while you were on the UN panel, you had boarded some of these Korean ships. What did you find there? Just describe it. What was it like, and what was the crew like, and how did you deal with them?
Well, I've boarded North Korean ships and foreign flag vessels, which were assisting the North Koreans. Well, the North Korean ships, you'll find that the ship is generally well cared for, although it's in a poor condition. And the ship carries a wealth of information in terms of its previous voyages. I don't want to speak too much in terms of what we had found, but we found a lot of information, not only about that particular voyage, but about other voyages as well. So it's actually like opening a window on the world of the tactics and modus operandi of the North Koreans in terms of where they've been, what they've done, what cargo they've carried, and who are the companies that they deal with. Now, one of the aspects that was revealed in our 2014 and 2015 reports is that they rely on networks worldwide of a few trusted individuals to assist them in terms of the movements of their ships, in terms of what cargo can be taken from the point of loading to the point of disembarkation, and to support their vessels all over the world, paying for things such as spares, crew fees, docking costs, and even vessel maintenance.
How were you treated? How were you treated when you boarded these ships?
No, we were treated well and with respect. There was no difficulty at all in terms of getting your movement around the ship. But clearly, none of them were speaking to us or anyone else. I think their line is that once they've been caught, not to speak to anybody other than a lawyer. And I found in the case of the Mudubong and the Chongchong gang in Panama that they would speak through their lawyer.
Japan appears to be shaping up as China's chief rival in the disputed South China Sea because it has a sustained, multi-pronged approach and a unique set of reasons to test Beijing's growing influence. VOA Asia's Jim Stevenson has more.
Since 2017, Japan has emerged as a force in the sea. It works with the United States on joint naval exercises, including one earlier this month that also involved warships from India and the Philippines. Japan has separately sent its Izumo-class helicopter carrier to the sea at least four times since 2017. That year, it took a three-month tour. Japan is helping Southeast Asian claimants to the South China Sea develop infrastructure and marine firepower. Japanese officials don't claim the sea, but a separate territorial dispute with China motivates them to keep a watch on Chinese influence. Regional analysts say Japanese citizens tend to support foreign policy targeting China. At least six other countries with no claims in the South China Sea sovereignty dispute have sent ships into the waterway over the past 3 years. All but the United States send ships too sporadically to cause major alarm in China, despite protests from Beijing's foreign ministry. The U.S. Navy has sailed in the sea 11 times under President Donald Trump alone. China worries most about the United States, followed by Japan, a U.S. treaty ally of nearly 60 years. Carl Thayer is emeritus professor at the University of New South Wales in Australia.
Japan is more northeast focused, but it does venture down to the South China Sea. You can't push Japan around without thinking about what the U.S. would do.
Also setting Japan apart, its government has sparred with China since 1996 over sovereignty in parts of the East China Sea. Jeffrey Kingston, history instructor at Temple University's Japan campus, says most Japanese fret over China's rise, giving their government a stronger mandate to check Chinese expansion through alliances with other countries.
I think there's a lot of concern about rising China and about North Korea. And so in this environment, I think the government, which in a way helps to stoke those anxieties, is seizing the opportunity to build these coalitions, partnerships.
China cites documents going back to dynastic years to show historic use of the sea to bolster its claim. Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam claim all or parts of the sea, which stretches from Hong Kong to Borneo. Their exclusive economic zones all overlap the 90% that China calls its own. Militarily weaker than Beijing, the Southeast Asian claimants resent China's use of reclaimed land to build up tiny islets for aircraft hangars, radar systems, and support for oil exploration. Claimant countries prize the sea as well for its marine shipping lanes and undersea reserves of gas and oil. Japan relies on it for raw materials and shipping routes for its exports. Japan's activity is not likely to stop China from operating in the sea's Paracel Islands, a chain it has controlled since the 1970s, or militarizing three major islets in the Spratly Archipelago. But the activity may help deter China from taking more islets claimed by other countries. Our thanks to Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. I'm Jim Stevenson, VOA Asia.
During Ramadan, when many in Muslim-majority Pakistan do not eat or drink during the day, sports enthusiasts turn to night games. For years, amateur cricketers in the capital, Islamabad, used empty roads or local playgrounds, any open space with lighting, to fulfill their passion. VOA's Aisha Tanzim shows us informal tournaments now are flourishing.
The tournament this year includes around 130 teams, but it was not organized by an established sports body. A local youth group that calls itself Combined Youth Organization came up with the idea. CYO advertised on Facebook, charged a minimal entry fee, around $20, and voila, before they knew it, it seemed like everyone in the area had started a team and signed up. Most are informal, groups of friends or neighbors from Islamabad and its sister city, Rawalpindi. CYO has permission to use only one playground, for which it pays all expenses, including the electricity bill. But the group is happy with the response.
In Ramzan, many of these people sit in markets after opening their fast. This year, all those who are passionate about sports, even those not linked to sports directly, joined us. We provided them with a healthy activity for 2 weeks.
The atmosphere is festive, with small vendors selling popcorn and other tidbits, children enjoying the games as spectators, and friends enjoying tea. The idea seems to appeal to visitors as well.
This atmosphere and such sporting activities for the youth should be made available across the country.
CYO members say they try to use these tournaments as opportunities to raise awareness about various issues. In the past, they have highlighted the importance of polio vaccination, the dangers of drug use, and supported victims of terrorism. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
Thank you for being with us for this special edition of VOA Asia Weekend. In Washington, I'm Ira Melman.